Question number 14978, Charles Turnbull, reel 3.
Mr. Turnbull, reel 3. Were you a member of the Boy Scouts, the Boys Brigade, Mr. Turnbull, as a child?
I was a member of the Boy Scouts for not a long period. It was through the local chapel. They had a scout leader, and through the local chapel I did join, and went on one camp in particular, which was not a long way from Headley Hall. Actually, it was at Haswell. And it was a tented camp. And while we were there, I think it rained practically every day. And I couldn't say that I was really thrilled to bits with the camping. And it left not really a good impression, that I can't remember staying in the Boy Scouts for a long period.
It was the camping you didn't like so much as the other part, the aspects of the scout.
I would say it was the camping idea that did put us off. And I think I must have got involved with probably other interests like my football and my cricket, and also I became interested in the tennis club later on, and they could probably have outweighed the Boy Scouts. When you're young, one can do everything. And my brother Harry, he was also in for a short period, but he became interested in quite a big way with the Boys Brigade and the St. John's Ambulance.
Boy Scouts, did you have to buy a uniform yourself?
We had to buy it ourselves. I can always remember having the neckerchief and the shirt, but you got it in bits and pieces. You didn't buy everything at once in them days.
How did you take to the disciplinary side of scouting?
Well, as usual, whatever the controller said, as long as he was an adult, you always abide by his decisions. There was part of your training that you had to respect your elders.
And you say you're only in a brief time. You've mentioned quite a number of your leisure activities, really. Growing up a young man at that time, sport was very important, as you've said. What other activities did you get up to?
Apart from sport, attending night school. After all, let's face it, after you didn't have a great deal of time left, that by the time you attended night school four times a week, and you did what work was required when you came home, and with being so keen about outside activities, and I did attend the local chapel when there was anything special on, through my mother's instigation. It was not a case of liking to go a great deal, but one had to fall in line with your parents' wishes.
The 1930s saw the rise of Hitlerism. Mm-hmm. What are your early memories at that time, coming up to the war, of things that were changing, you know, preparation? Mm.
Well, I can remember reading about what was happening in Germany, the rise of Nazism, and I was working at the co-op then, and I had no ever any fancy at all for joining the territorials or anything like that. That was far, far from my mind. I had no inspiration for anything like that at all. But as the years went on, I had the feeling, probably when we got up to 1938, that things were getting a little bit close. You could see through reading the newspapers and the wireless that really things were starting to happen. And then later on, when it came obvious that Germany had invaded Poland, well, being a thinking person, you began to think, well, it looks as though something may happen in the future. Although in the background, I did really think that probably something might come to avert it, that really things might not get to that state. And one dreaded to think that it may.
Was this common within the community? Were people beginning to talk about the fears of war, particularly bearing in mind the older ones who'd gone through the First World War?
Well, the people who'd gone through the First World War, we had a next door neighbour who'd served in the World War One, and really he suffered from, I would say, nervous exhaustion. And this gentleman used to talk to us, and he used to say, I've got me doubts that something really may happen again. It'll be hoped that really things don't get as bad as what they were during my service. But people like that were starting to think. Although the younger generation like myself, you were so concerned with what was happening in your young life and enjoying really your spare time activities, that you still thought that really, well, it may be averted. But of course in the end, after Chamberlain went on his mission and came back and said what he had to say, it still, I would say, remained a bit doubtful to the thinking person.
Do you recall when things were beginning to happen in the area, preparation for war, I mean, such things as protecting buildings, this kind of thing? Did that start to come in before war actually started itself?
Before the war actually started, I can remember we started to go down to the local fire station. That really, I think we had, and we used to go there after working hours at the Co-op. And people who worked at the Co-op, the men, who really knew that if something happened, they would have to go, whether they wanted to or not, being that type of a white-coated job. And we went down for lectures, I think, on first aid and what may happen with gas drill and things like that. That really, there was an aspect where it was something we might have to become prepared for.
Do you recall what you were doing on the day war broke out, when that announcement was made? Where were you?
I was in the house, actually, when the announcement was made. And this gentleman next door, who I've already said was of a nervous disposition, came in and he said, right, we'll have to go into the gardens now and we'll have to dig a trench, which I must say at the time made us smile a little bit and sort of think, well, things is not as drastic as that yet. But he insisted that he went out into the garden and started to dig a trench, which later on we had to do for the shelters which had to be installed.
People around you, you've mentioned the gentleman next door. What about the rest of the community when this announcement was made? Was it shock, surprise?
Well, it was a shock. And I would say in the majority of cases, not a great surprise, more of shock. That people might have to go away, and there again, who weren't tuned up to modern warfare, thought we would get back to life in the trenches as it happened in World War One, which the old soldiers used to relate about. And of course, so much had happened with casualties that people had never forgot World War One, and they were appalled by the idea of young people having to go away again. And I must say that my mother was really, really upset, because I was the eldest boy, and although I said to myself that I was the apple of her eye, I don't know whether the eldest child comes into it, but in her opinion, I was sort of the blue-eyed boy. And she didn't like the idea that I may have to go away, which I knew, of course, that I would. So I did not volunteer, that I knew that really eventually I would be called up, and I was prepared to really enjoy things while I could, and how take it from there.
How old were you at this time, 1939?
I would be 22.
So you waited for call up.
Call up.
Was there some form of registering system for adult males?
Yes, we had to, you know, the conscription came in and we had to register. And then eventually, at that time, we lived in Edward Street. And I can always remember the day the papers came. And when the papers came, the letter that morning, my brother Harry, who was younger than I, and he was working on the railway, it followed in my grandfather's footsteps. And there again, my mother had sort of leanings towards me. I can always remember when we came in, instead of reading the address correctly on the envelope, when Harry came in, we both came in at the same time, and she said, "Harry, that's your call-up papers." And of course, Harry opened them out. He said, "Mother," he said, "this is not my papers. It's our Charlie's papers." And I can remember the tears start to flow. So anyhow, it was a thing that had to be accepted. And it did say that really when we would have to travel.
Before we go on with that, obviously some time had elapsed between the outbreak of the war and your papers coming. What were you doing in the wartime situation as a civilian? What was happening in your work and around you?
All that happened was, carried on working at the co-op and doing what was necessary just down at the local fire station. Going down there for lectures and you know, a drill was carried out at the local co-op of what might happen.
This would be in what, the case fire drill, bomb drill?
That's right, in case of an air raid.
Did you have duties, like night duties at the co-op to look for raids or bombs or what have
you? No night duties. No, initially things were quite quiet. There wasn't nothing happening very much locally apart from people having to go away and being called up.
So you had your calling up papers, Mr. Turnbull. Take me through, please, the process between getting those papers and moving into the army situation.
I might say that when I received my calling up papers, it said on the calling up papers, Royal Army Service Corps. And my mother said, well, that's not too bad. Really, better than the light infantry. So the call of day came January the 17th, when I had to report to the RLO at Durham Station.
This was
1940. So I got on the train at Hetton Station, 9 o'clock on the morning, and reported to Durham Station.
Did you have to take anything with you? I'm thinking in terms of night attire, toothbrushes, this kind of thing. Nothing like that.
No. We went from Darlington and were transported to Darlington. When we got off the train at Darlington, there was NCOs from the Durham Light Infantry there, and we were paraded on the station, of course in our civilian clothes, gas masks, and lined up and taken down to a school in Darlington. We were left in the schoolyard. It was winter weather, snow on the ground. And then we eventually found out we were taken into a room where there was three tables with an officer behind each table. And those tables represented the 10th Battalion, the Durham Light Infantry, the 11th Battalion, the Durham Light Infantry, and the 12th Battalion, which also was known as the Tyneside Scottish. Naturally, when a group of people congregate together, one soon teams up with a number of persons, and the lad that I came in contact with first of all was a lad from Hortney Spring called Martin Smith, and also a lad from Bolden Colliery called Jack Shreve, who I soon found out played football for Charlton Athletic. There again, with me being a football fiend, well, him and I had great association with each other, and naturally with playing for a first division club, which had always been my ambition, he was really my hero from then on. So a sergeant who we came in contact with was called George Pratt, who had served with the Territorials in Spennymoor. And he was quite a character, and he said, "Now lads, if you want to stick together," he says, "when you go into that room, the three of you go to the left hand table." He says, "That'll be the 10th Battalion, the Durham Light Infantry," which is my battalion. So we stuck to each other like glue, so that when we went in, we would get to that table.
So at this point, your forms had said Royal Army Service Corps, and you were just into the Durham Light Infantry.
Durham Light Infantry.
And you never thought anything untoward about this at all?
No, no. Right, so really, by this time, we'd spent most of the day after going into this room in the schoolyard, which wasn't very good conditions, because it was cold, snow on the ground, and we began to wonder what's going to happen eventually. So anyhow, what happened eventually was, and it was getting quite late by this time, that we were paraded again into the different units, 10th, 11th, and the 12th, or the Tyneside Scottish, and transported again back to the railway station. And from Darlington, the 10th Battalion were taken to South Shields. After we got off the train at South Shields, we were transported through South Shields up to the Westall Road Schools. When we arrived there, we were taken over to the sheds, given a palias, and stuffed the palias with straw, and taken to a classroom and bedded down there for the night. That then was the first day of our introduction to an army routine.
What were your feelings?
Well, it was something that really I'd conditioned myself to accept, and sort of made up my mind that now I've got to go into the army, as usual, make the best of it and do the best you can. No more thoughts about it, which I said was really a sort of associated with the way that you'd been brought up.
I hadn't any thought at this time that it may be dangerous.
Not really. Not really. I knew then, really, you would be conditioned to face what had to come in the future, and we would have to train accordingly and try and meet the conditions as they came along. The words, I can always remember the words of Sergeant Pratt, who, as I said, was quite a character, Geordie Pratt. He was a good-natured soul and a good sergeant who was had done his time in the territorials, and he said to us three, he said, "Now, lads," he said, "you're in the forces, make the best of it." And he said, "My advice to you is," and I can always remember the words, "never volunteer for anything, never refuse anything." And I might say that during my army career, I really always remembered really that first approach. So from then on, really, the next year, we were drafted into companies. And the three of us, again, we kept together and we were admitted to A Company of the 10th DLI. The conditions at first, well, it was obvious they weren't very adequate, because the dishing out of uniforms was very haphazard. One day you might receive a pair of boots and a pair of socks. The next day you might get a blouse, an army blouse, and probably a pair of trousers dished out. Then the next day you might get a forage cap and a great coat. Ill-fitting. Not very smart. And I think that after being in a week, we were allowed a weekend pass. And I can always remember coming back to Hetley Hall and marching up Edward Street, where we lived. My mother was at the door. And when she saw me coming up the street, a great coat on that was down to my ankles, she started to cry. And really, it took her a long time to get over it, to think, and she always said, I can always remember saying to my father, "Hey, oh, Charlie's never ever worn big boots like that. He'll never get used to that." And that was the initial response. Anyhow, after the weekend, well, it was back to South Shields and back to a routine of learning how to drill. And I would say that really I accepted the conditions.
What you've mentioned, the fact that you're lying on a school floor, they were obviously feeding you. How well?
As far as I can remember, I would say adequate.
The first time coming under army discipline, how did that take to you? How did you take to that?
Reasonably well. I'd made up my mind to accept it. I can remember Sergeant Pratt, as I said, was very good. And his discipline was good. As long as we obeyed his instructions in a reasonable manner. The company sergeant major was Harry Stalker. And he had been a territorial, quite a strong figure. And the man who that really we learned to instantly obey his orders without any hesitation and jump to it right, left and centre was the regimental sergeant major, Stan Holcroft. And on the when we had to parade for him, we had to be really on our toes, otherwise our knuckles were wrapped.
What was the first thing they taught you in drill?
Well, I would say really the first thing was how to... we had to learn to how to use our rifle.
Did you get those pretty early weapons? Did they come through quickly?
I would say fairly quickly. The first days, of course, was how to fall in, how to dress, how to turn, about turn, right turn, left turn, halt.
Where were you doing these? In the school
yard? In school yard.
The school itself, was it a cold place? And was it heated? Were you comfortable in there?
I would say reasonable. I would say that really, my mind doesn't carry us back too far in that respect, but I can't remember being sort of violently discontented. I used to think that when we had to do things like kit parades, and we had to lay our kits out in a uniform manner in their schoolrooms, I used to think, really, what has this got to do with our training for the army?
How often were they, kit parades?
Once a week, Saturday mornings.
Take me through a kit parade. How did you lay your kit out? It must have been in a certain way.
A certain way. Your blanket had to be on the bottom, and everything had to be folded correctly and put in the right order. Even down to your toothbrush, and your boots had to be shined and polished and cleaned. But everything had to be uniform.
Who took the parade? Who would do the kit inspection?
The officer in charge of the platoon.
Do you recall who that was?
I can remember names. Well, I can go through them, really. The captain that we had of A Company was Captain Peter Stock, who I had great respect for. He was smart, tall, good bearing. And we knew straight away that his command would have to be obeyed. His second in command was a Captain Robson. He was a captain as well. The lieutenants that we had lieutenants in the company. We had a lieutenant, our names had come back to me. There was a Delaney, Lieutenant Denali. It was later on, probably, there was a Lieutenant Brutnall. And, of course, I can remember the company commander was, as I've already said, Captain Stock. And the battalion commander was Colonel Marley.
Did you see much of him in those early days?
Not a lot. Not initially. Not till the time came that we had to go to France. And I can remember his second in command was Major Hall. Another name that came to my mind, we had a Captain Dean, who was in charge of a company. So that really these people had a reflection and a bearing where really they were smart in their appearance, and you could really tell that really, well, they had something about them whereby they had to be respected. But I can always remember that I had great respect for this Captain Stock. And really, I found out that really later on, I don't know why, but I was singled out and appointed as his company clerk. I don't know why that I should be selected for that position, but from Westall Road, we went down to Baring Street Schools later on.
How long were you at Westall Road?
Not a long period. It must have been after our initial training that really I think the companies must have been posted to different schools to further the training in other respects.
Before we move on to that phase, you've been talking about the officers and you've mentioned Sergeant Pratt. What other NCOs did you have, do you recall?
I would say that no one left an impression with me. I don't know why that should be, but he seemed to be the person who that I took more notice of, and really no names of NCOs apart from him seemed to register.
So you were drilling in these very early days at Westall Road Schools.
Mm-hmm.
Being in the light infantry, did they drill you at light infantry pace from
yes,
the very beginning?
Right from the beginning, yes.
It must have been pretty hard on your feet.
Well, that's a thing that really didn't bother me, and which was rather surprising, because as a boy, my mother used to always have problems with my shoes when she used to buy them from the co-op. That really on my feet I had sort of a bit of a double joint.